I was saying a few minutes ago, panic overtook the director of the series and myself because the featured speaker hadn't arrived. We thought, well, what if he thought it was another year? And he's booked well ahead. And so we began to think desperately of alternatives. And I was trying to work out how long I could really run myself on the future of the West and the rise of the rest. But then we thought with great relief, the Vice Chancellor is here and he can be relied on. He can be relied on to fill the gap at any time. So we felt a good deal better. But then there was relief as Dr. Don Russell appeared. Now, I was been told in my strict writing instructions from the director of the Festival of Ideas that I have to keep introductory remarks very brief, so I will. Simply to say that Don Russell, I think, has had a unique range of experience as a public servant, principal minder to a treasurer and a prime minister, and then ambassador to the United States, and then subsequently a global asset manager. He's notorious for putting politicians into two categories, what he calls the pleasers and the doers, and I think he has very little time for the pleasers. But tonight he's going to talk about the future of the West and the rise of the West, and then we'll have a comparatively short but deeply meaningful and intense question and answer session at the end. So I invite you to welcome Dr. Don Russell.
Well, thank you, Barry. It's always important to make an entrance, but I apologise for cutting it so fine tonight. Well, it is a pleasure and a privilege. Would you have said you were a pleaser or a doer?
Doer, unfortunately, yes. But I didn't please a number of people, including your treasurer.
On that note, the future of the West and the rise of the rest. Now, I'm sure we all remember being taught that the American Revolution was a bourgeois revolution and as such was no revolution at all. There was no class struggle, no dramatic rearranging of property rights, and hardly anyone got killed. The French fleet stationed itself off Yorktown. They put a line through George III, and American business interests were allowed to get on doing what they do best, making money and accumulating capital. You might wonder why I'm starting back in 1776, when if the present is the past and the future has arrived, then the past must hardly be worth talking about at all. But to deal with the future of the West, it is important to understand both what makes the West and what drives those countries whose dramatic economic growth over the past two decades is threatening to destabilize the existing world order. In what follows, I've consciously not commented on how all of this might impact on Australia. The future of the West and the rise of the rest is a debate that predates the current global crisis. It was prompted very much by the extraordinary rates of growth observed in emerging economies such as China, India, Russia, and Brazil. These countries all have large populations and sizable existing economies, and simply extrapolating recent growth quite quickly transforms them into very large economies, potentially capable of challenging the US, Europe, and Japan for global leadership. Many have worried about this, especially those who like to think in terms of the strategic relationships between countries. How will America view a decline in its relative importance? How will proud but recently poor countries behave when they become economically powerful? It is easy to become alarmed. Others have seen positive aspects. People had become so taken with the rise of the developing world that when the housing crisis in the US first surfaced, it was confidently predicted that developing country growth would be so strong that world growth would decouple from the inevitable slowdown in the US. As often happens in economics, reality has a nasty habit of catching up with even the most confidently held theories. Once we had forsaken decoupling, The world went back to scrutinising the US economy, accepting once again that it is the driver of world growth. However, as the market excitedly discovers green shoots and gains comfort from the fact that the rate of decline is slowing, I do detect a renewed interest in the growth prospects for emerging economies, and I'm sure that people will once again focus on relative growth differentials. But let me return to the American Revolution. Very simply, the American Revolution was genuinely revolutionary and quite subversive. And its subversive qualities continue to reverberate around the world, changing cultures and changing how we all live. And what was so subversive about the American Revolution? It created the notion that the state has no life separate from its citizens, that individuals have to be protected from their government, and that sovereignty rightly belongs to the mass of ordinary, individual, and equal citizens. And why is this relevant for tonight's lecture? Because while it is always difficult to identify why the economies of some countries grow and deliver rising living standards and others do not, it is clear that a country's culture is a driving force. Some might be moved to say, it's not the economy, stupid, it's the culture. But what the American Revolution delivered was a unique culture. For those who have visited the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, they will have noticed that the Gettysburg Address and Lincoln's second inaugural speech are carved into the walls. Some may have got to see American schoolchildren chanting the Gettysburg Address with their eyes closed. It is impressive that American schoolchildren know the Gettysburg Address, but the final words, while moving, do not seem contentious. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. But the words do have meaning, for they go well beyond the notion that government should subject themselves to regular popular elections, and anyone from Europe visiting the US at the time of Lincoln would have been shocked at what they meant in practice. Universal suffrage is easy to understand and is now accepted in most countries as a necessary condition for legitimacy. In years gone by, a monarch would like to have their sovereignty ratified by the divine support of God. These days, governments like to rest their sovereignty on majority support of the electorate. In some countries, universal suffrage is a recent and somewhat awkward development, and in others, it is viewed as a distraction or unwanted indulgence, but the point still stands. But viewing democracy as a handy way of gaining legitimacy is quite different from viewing it as a device for changing how a government and a society operate. The boundaries of democracy are the issue, and in all countries, these boundaries are contentious. The notion that deference should be paid to rulers comes easily to most governments, but by the time of Lincoln, the habit of the heart, as de Tocqueville put it, was well entrenched, and the ruder conventions of equality were an accepted part of American democracy. But this is not where it started in America, and it did not have to turn out the way it did. Why things evolved as they did and the consequences that flowed provide useful insights into the events that we have been witnessing in key emerging market countries. Back in pre-revolutionary America, many had strong views that democracy was the government of the worst, and that some form of hierarchical authority, which gave weight to the wise or the holy, was where the new republic should ground its legitimacy. When it came to the ordinary people, some form of representative democracy seemed a sensible option. Even Thomas Jefferson himself wrote in 1776, "A choice by the people themselves is not generally distinguished by its wisdom." As a young man, George Washington would speak of the grazing multitude, and John Adams, the common herd of mankind. The beasts, the rabble, the idiot multitude filled people with alarm. But by the time the federal constitution was ratified in 1788, the Americans had turned their backs on a mixed government, or a government which gave sovereignty to the states, and instead deliberately chose to place sovereignty with the people. They put in place a government that was purely democratic in every aspect of its makeup. It was probably fortunate that the US Constitution was in stone before the Paris mob and the excesses of the French Revolution reverberated around the world. But the Constitution was no rhetorical flourish. It involved a range of well-understood trade-offs. The price for placing sovereignty with the people was a president with powers well beyond those contemplated in 1776. The price of a powerful president was a powerful Congress quite separate from the executive and a Bill of Rights and a Supreme Court that would protect individuals from their government and the tyranny of the majority. The 1788 Constitution built the United States, allowed it to absorb vast numbers of people from all over the world, and enabled it to stay together, notwithstanding its history of extreme violence and bloodshed. It also enabled it to become the most dynamic and productive society the world has ever known. 200 years later, the balances built into the Constitution are still to the fore in the way that individuals are celebrated and individual achievement venerated. The fact that the culture has evolved and has made the country rich and powerful has only reinforced American support for their way of life. On the political front, it is hard to overlook the fact that the popular House of Representatives impeached Bill Clinton, while the more deliberative Senate, chaired by the Chief Justice, duly acquitted him, as set out in the Constitution. Or that a man with the name Barack Hussein Obama, the son of a Kenyan student and a one-term senator from Illinois, was elected president, replacing a predecessor with quite different approach. American democracy has developed a self-correcting quality which gives it a resilience and flexibility that can make other political systems seem brittle by comparison. The founding fathers would have been impressed. However, at the time of the Constitution's ratification, it was not that clear how the Constitution would work in practice. But as a written document, its principles are hardwired into the American political system. And while it has been for every generation to put substance into its provisions, there has been no escaping its fundamental philosophy. Andrew Jackson swept to power in 1828 on the back of mass public support and in the process defined American democracy. We had entered the world of a mass press, popular conventions, petition campaigns, and the power of ordinary people. And from this point, there was no turning back. At the time, it appeared to many that the reign of King Mob had commenced. All through the Civil War, and much to the distress of his staff, Lincoln would sit and receive an endless stream of petitioners. They thought it was their right, and Lincoln saw it as an important way of making his government accessible to the people. Lincoln had superb political touch and was much loved, but there is no escaping the fact that even in the midst of the bloodiest war the Americans have ever fought, Lincoln still had to earn his authority. He could not simply take it. It is fair to say that no political leader anywhere in the world at that time could have countenanced such a situation. There is therefore a basis to notions of American exceptionalism, and it is not that the country is large, brash, and powerful. It is that the Americans have quite consciously built a political system and a culture that is different from that found elsewhere in the world. Equality and the importance of the individual are very much at the core of their beliefs. And while their system is different from that found in other countries, people around the world instinctively understand what it is about. It is a remarkable thing that no matter where people come from, no one has to be taught how to be an American when they arrive in the country. When we look around the world and try and account for why some countries are successful and others stagnate, a key driver is the relationship between the state and its people. Countries with a state that is a predatory force, that preys on its citizens and which is in tight control of its population, tend to stagnate. On the other hand, countries with a strong society that is not overawed by a powerful state tend to do well. We will see that one important reason why key emerging market countries have recently started to grow strongly is that these countries have seen changes that have strengthened their societies and diminished the power of the state. How then does a change in the relationship between a state and its people influence how states behave and how they relate to each other? For me, this is the key question that needs to be addressed. But before we look at that, let us consider how the unusual nature of American society influences how the US relates to other countries. This is important for two reasons. Firstly, it is insightful in its own right, and secondly, how the US responds to a relative decline in its economic power will be an important determinant of how other countries react. One of the core arguments favoring a powerful president was the desire to have an American leader who could deal with the absolute monarchs in Europe. The president is the commander-in-chief, and while all foreign treaties have to be approved by the Senate, and the president needs congressional approval to declare war, the president does have considerable power when it comes to defence and foreign policy. To this extent, the US tends to behave much like other countries when it comes to looking after its natural national interest. It has a strong hand, and the Americans tend to play it as ruthlessly as anyone. But US power is always constrained by the fact that final authority lies with the American people. And in many situations, because of their size and wealth, Americans have the luxury of conducting themselves in an altruistic manner when it comes to dealing with the world. This brings an idealistic quality to American foreign policy that other countries often misunderstand or find strange. At its most basic, it is very difficult to convince Americans to die for an interest. And if America goes to war, it has to be for a principle. The Americans were deeply scarred by their involvement in the First World War, not because of the casualties, which were not heavy, but because the Treaty of Versailles reflected so little of the US agenda and Woodrow Wilson's 14 points. Far from making the world safe for democracy, the Treaty of Versailles ended up reinforcing the position of the old imperial powers, England and France, and punishing Germany. The Americans were determined not to make that mistake again. With the Second World War, they were determined there would be no negotiated outcome. Unconditional surrender was the only option, and it would be an American blueprint that determined the post-war architecture. The result was the Marshall Plan, the rebuilding of Germany, the remodeling of Japan, the UN, GATT, trade liberalisation, Bretton Woods, the IMF, and the World Bank. On one level, it might look as though they were making the world safe for America, but in reality, they felt a compulsion to remodel the world to make it better. An idealistic America is important because while it often puzzles, it is an important factor softening the impact that the US has on others. In the end, it was the Americans who viewed the events in the former Yugoslavia as a moral issue which required a response. The Europeans were unable or unwilling to take responsibility, notwithstanding their growing claims to an emerging European identity. If America's immense power had been applied over the years without an overlay of idealism, the overall effect would have been intolerable. Any diminishing of America's relative standing would have been seized upon with relish. This will stand America in good stead as other countries become relatively more significant. There will always be a leadership role for America because of its idealism and as long as the country retains a capability of independent action. And this second proviso is important. America needs the resources and the confidence that comes from success. If America loses the magic, then it will be difficult to maintain support for an idealistic foreign policy. Their behaviour will become increasingly erratic and potentially destabilising to the rest of the world. Energy, flexibility and innovation are hardwired into their system, which are the key drivers of growth which will stand them in good stead. However, the current crisis is of such a magnitude that some have worried that the political response will lead to an unwarranted and counterproductive intrusion from government into US business. The fact that such concerns are already surfacing while the economy continues to worsen suggests that America will come out of this recession with its customary energy, although it might take longer than usual. But before turning to the success story in the developing world, I would like to turn briefly to Europe. As already mentioned, much of what makes America America can be traced back to the European philosophers of the 18th century, and the English are a case in point. In many ways, they were the most advanced of the developed countries at the time. They fully understood that effective government had to be grounded on some measure of tacit support or understanding from all the most important sections of the community. Tolerance, the rule of law, and a powerful parliament enabled them to operate very effectively, despite having to accommodate a monarchy, an entrenched aristocracy, and an unpleasant class system. If asked, they would have traced it all back to the Glorious Revolution of 1688-89 and the revolutionary settlement that put the parliament at the centre, made the monarch operate within the law, and provided for religious tolerance. Economic and other interests were reconciled in the parliament, and the government of the day was properly supported and resourced. The tolerance and stability of the period led to a flowering of English innovation and ingenuity, which drove the subsequent Industrial Revolution. It was the time of Sir Isaac Newton and the Royal Society of London for the improvement of natural knowledge. In their smug way, the English thought they had discovered the secret of successful government: reason, compromise, and tolerance. There was no room here for King Mob. This was the country that the American Federalists would have built if they had been allowed to. and the English had much to show for it. 15 years after 1689, the Parliament had provided the Duke of Marlborough with sufficient resources to defeat the Sun King, Louis XIV, at the Battle of Blenheim and rearrange the map of Europe. It did not escape notice that the absolute monarch, Louis XIV, could have prevented William of Orange sailing from Holland to England on the Protestant wind, but chose to facilitate it on the grounds that further conflict between Parliament and the English Crown could only be to his advantage. The smart commentators also noticed that effective parliaments brought strength to governments, not weakness. But the English never fully embraced the notion that the state was the servant of the people. It was Her Majesty's government, and the opposition belonged to Her Majesty. From the mid-19th century, the English were struggling. They knew they had to accommodate more of the people in the political system to maintain its legitimacy. They transported trade unionists and the Chartists to Australia, but they could not stop the tide of history. Driven by their own needs and the beacon across the Atlantic, they eventually extended the vote. Their motive had more to do with a need to build legitimacy than a deeply ingrained belief that people have a right to be actively involved in the workings of government. The English have always been keen that the boundaries of democracy be drawn in a way that maintains the prerogatives of the state, and this continues to this day. The floating duck house of Sir Peter Vigors may not be as powerful an image as Marie Antoinette's Let Them Eat Cake, but it is close. English attitudes are, if anything, more pronounced in other countries around the world. Tolerance and reason are good, but of themselves are not enough to elevate a country into a position of global leadership. Because without something extra, the underlying motive of such countries remains national interest. Well understood and realistically held notions of national interest help nations deal with each other, but it is a path that leads to power balances, coalitions. In this world, relative economic strength and military capabilities come to the fore. It is a world of economic nationalism and diminished global opportunities, and if irreconcilable differences develop, it is a world of destructive tension. Countries would be back dealing with each other on a zero-sum basis. In such an environment, it would be hard for the extraordinary wealth creation of the past two decades to continue. It would be an understandable but unfortunate development if America would go down this route in a misguided attempt to maintain national prestige. But it would represent a break with their past. And it is only likely to happen if America experiences an extended period of stagnation and failure. In this environment, America would find it increasingly difficult to fund an idealistic foreign policy, and a disenchanted American electorate could force future presidents to behave in a far less generous manner to other countries. The independent authority of the American people, which previously had been a virtue, would become a negative. But America's strengths are fundamental and will not disappear as a result of the current crisis. The US dominates higher education, they spend more on research and development than other countries, and they are demographically vibrant. Immigration tends to make countries more dynamic and successful, and the observation that half of all Silicon Valley startups have an immigrant connection is no accident. America's culture can incorporate people from different backgrounds, a feat that both Europe and Asia seem incapable of achieving. Moreover, as we shall see, the current crisis is likely to lead China to reduce its trade surplus as the Chinese encourage greater domestic spending. This can only be to the benefit of the US. US companies already operate around the world and are a major beneficiary of foreign growth. A significant number of US companies already earn more than 50% of their revenue abroad, and the process whereby US firms turn themselves into truly global firms rather than US firms that operate abroad is accelerating. America has been through many episodes where it is thought that they had been overtaken by the world, the most recent being the notion in the mid-1980s that Japan was the future, and each time they have rebounded, making a virtue of their adaptability. Their relative position may well slip, but the US is still likely to rebound from its current problems, as it has in the past, with its institutions and culture intact. America will continue to be a major power, and its influence in the world will continue to be magnified by the leadership role she will continue to be afforded. Let me now turn to the key emerging market economies that are driving this debate. China and India are the most interesting because of their enormous populations, but the changed circumstances of Russia and Brazil have also been profound. I will focus on China and India and make some observations about Russia and Brazil. These four countries, China, India, Brazil, and Russia, are known as the BRIC countries. First coined by the marketing department of Goldman Sachs in 2001, the BRICS have developed a life of their own, and the term is now seen as synonymous with emerging market success. Investors can invest and trade a range of BRIC securities as a way of profiting from the success of these countries. At the invitation of the Russian president, the BRIC leaders held their first summit in June of 2009. In fact, it was yesterday. While Goldman Sachs would be amused, the only common thread that binds the four countries is natural resources. China and India are big consumers. Brazil and Russia are big suppliers. The summit was doubtless more symbolic than real, but it does underlie the strategic significance of natural resources in a world where developing countries are expanding strongly. China is unusual in that it has made the transition from a faltering, centrally planned economy to a successful, market-oriented economy while leaving the Communist Party in control. It was very much a conscious decision of the Chinese leadership and can trace back to 1978 and Deng Xiaoping. By the 1970s, China was confronted not only with Japan's success story, but that of Korea, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. China's poor performance was not only an embarrassment, it was undermining the authority of the Chinese leadership. It became a question of what did China have to do? And in the first instance, it meant loosening central controls, making the country attractive to foreign capital, and creating business entities that behave like private companies. Initially, they had the Japanese model as an example, with its emphasis on an undervalued exchange rate and rapid economic export growth. But with the fading of Japan's success story and the growing doubts as to the wisdom of building up ever larger international reserves, China has begun to behave more conventionally. Before the crisis, this involved lifting the exchange rate and generally discouraging the expansion of low-value production. With the crisis, the need to rebalance the economy away from exports to higher production for the domestic economy has accelerated. As part of this process, imports will grow and the current account surplus should fall. Rather than producing goods and selling them to foreigners and receiving US Treasury bills, the Chinese will receive goods. This will lift living standards in China, but it will also expand production around the world and take pressure off policymakers in the US and Europe. From the beginning, people have been doubtful as to whether a modern capitalist system can be grafted onto communist infrastructure. But at every turn, the Chinese authorities have made it work. Very clearly, the message that the Chinese learned from the other successful Asian countries is that a nation's strength comes from its economy, not from aggression or notions of empire. But more is going on in China than simply expanding the economy and securing access to natural resources. It is accepted that knowledge and continued technological innovation are the keys to the future, and Chinese society has to evolve to make this happen. We see attention to building national cohesiveness and cultural creativity, and a desire to make Chinese society and Chinese ideas attractive. The heavy investment that the Chinese made in the Olympics was designed to showcase China's success to the rest of the world, but it also had a domestic audience in mind. The authorities' response to the Beijing earthquake was large-scale and rapid. The presence of Chinese leaders on television reassuring people and promising assistance was not the response of an old-time authoritarian government. This was the response of a government who believes that people matter. The Communist Party may still be in power, but authority has already moved away from the state and certainly from the central authorities in Beijing. This process will continue because it is part of the virtuous circle of success. More individual discretion means a stronger and more attractive Chinese society, which drives further economic success. The Communist Party has no intention of embracing King Mob anytime soon, and old habits will die hard, but there can be no turning back. Human rights around the world will always be a concern to Americans, and this concern links directly back to fundamental values that Americans see as self-evident truths. The importance that the US places on human rights will always grate with the Chinese because they see it as an unwarranted interference and more of a political device than a legitimate concern. The Chinese are never likely to accommodate the Americans on their human rights agenda, but over time they have been content to allow individual Chinese to have a growing influence on how the country operates and how individual Chinese lead their lives. The combination of America's human rights agenda and growing international recognition of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights over the last 60 years has reinforced the economic forces giving status to individuals. The rapid decentralization of authority in China to the regions is an important development because it brings a degree of competitive federalism, which is a plus, but it also complicates situations which require a national response. It is true that China now has resources to build up its military, and this is happening. Some view this as destabilizing, but it is more accurate to see increased defense spending as a byproduct of success than as an indicator of future aggressive intent. Confucianism was a major influence on Voltaire and other Enlightenment philosophers of the 18th century who celebrated Confucianism for its reliance on reason rather than divinity. The combination of a state supportive of economic progress and Confucianism and its attention to acquiring knowledge, behaving ethically, maintaining social stability, and creating a well-ordered civilization augurs well. India too has witnessed a sea change in the way its economy is managed. From the time of Nehru, India had embraced the notion of a mixed economy inspired by central planning in the Soviet Union, but with private ownership. The result was licensed Raj, a highly intrusive system of licenses overseen by a large Indian bureaucracy. By the early 1990s, economic stagnation and political dislocation had pushed India's democracy to a point where a new approach was feasible. India already had the example of Japan, Korea, and Taiwan, but growing success in China and the collapse of the Soviet Union made the existing structure untenable. Manmohan Singh, Minister of Finance 1991 to 1996, was the driving force behind dismantling the worst excesses of licensed Raj and charting a new direction, lowering tariffs and making India attractive to international investment. Sonia Gandhi, widow of former Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi and chairperson of the ruling United Progressive Alliance, appointed Manmohan Singh as Prime Minister after the success of the Congress Party in 2004. This has continued the process that Manmohan Singh commenced in 1991. The result has been a decade and more of strong growth that has transformed the country. Again, there's been a marked shift in power away from the state to individuals and to society at large. Success has brought an exuberance to the country that will not be extinguished by the current crisis. The Congress-led coalition was returned to office in March 2009 with a larger number of seats and less dependence on minor parties. It will no longer be dependent on the Communist Party. The victory was a triumph for Sonia Gandhi and Manmohan Singh, who was returned as Prime Minister, the first Prime Minister to be re-elected since Nehru. Indian politics tends to operate at a regional level, and the clear-cut nature of the victory can be seen as an endorsement of the natural national focus on growth and the approach of the Prime Minister. India's great strength is its democracy. It is messy, chaotic and unplanned, and in many ways it is very similar to the US. Like the US, the consumer is king. The Chinese can hold down consumption and force the nation to save by running a large current account surplus, but this is not an option for India. However, India has advantages over China in that capital tends to be invested more carefully and the country is demographically more dynamic. India faces a youth bulge, while China has a youth gap. Popular culture in America long ago stamped its imprint on all sections of society. If everyone is equal, then anyone's tastes is as good as anyone else's, and what is generally acclaimed is what thrives. Many have bemoaned the spread of American culture around the world, seeing it as an insidious byproduct of America's power. America's influence is subversive, but subversion comes from the notion of equality, not the nature of American culture. As people come to see themselves as good as anyone else, then culture becomes based on popular tastes. People like many aspects of American culture, but they pick and choose, layering on a heavy local component when it suits. There is a measure of truth in the notion that Bollywood is the future of global culture. Elite culture is therefore under threat in all successful emerging countries as culture becomes broadly based. In stratified societies, this is resented, but in reality, it is a natural byproduct of the forces that are driving economic success. Empowering individuals, economic growth, and popular culture all go together. Having broken with the past, India is now committed to continuing on its current path. Peace and stability is now widely accepted as a key prerequisite for growth. India has moved away from the self-righteousness of the Nehru period and the more belligerent attitude of the Indira Gandhi years. Growth is the objective and conflict is seen as a negative. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, will meet in Russia just before the BRICS summit. As part of the SCO discussions, the Indian Prime Minister will meet the Pakistani President. This is a measure of India's newfound interest in stabilising the conflict in the region. Some in the US might think that India could be a natural balance to a growing China, but it is most unlikely that India would be at all comfortable with such a role, and for similar reasons, China is unlikely to want to face off against India. Russia and Brazil are interesting in that both are large and both have recently joined the ranks of high-growth countries. Both have experienced something of a sea change in recent years in how they manage their economies. Brazil has a long history of failed governments involving military coups and impeachment. The election of Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in 2002 and his subsequent re-election in 2006 has brought a measure of reform and pragmatic moderation to Brazilian politics. Lula is a founding member of the Workers' Party, has a populist background and wide public support. Economic success will encourage Brazil to continue with a reformist agenda and will provide the resources to fund social projects. It will also strengthen Brazilian democracy. Russia will always be an important player on the world stage because of its size and nuclear arsenal. But of late, it has gained world attention more for its economic success and its strategic holdings of natural resources. At the end of 1999, Boris Yeltsin resigned the presidency and handed the position to Vladimir Putin, the newly appointed prime minister. Putin then won the 2000 election and was re-elected in 2004. Putin's authority rests very much on the accepted belief that living standards and the quality of life have improved significantly over the course of his presidency. Continued economic success will further consolidate the power of the new president and Prime Minister Putin. Russian governments are less constrained than most, but they do have to submit to the electorate. Their behaviour therefore differs greatly from authoritarian Russian governments of the past. The biggest difference is the understanding that economic growth and rising living standards are the glue that holds the country together. Because of its history, Russia is more likely to use growing economic strength to achieve some of its long-standing strategic objectives, but at the end of the day, they realise that the economic imperative is overriding. Neither Brazil nor Russia is as large as China or India, but they have significant economic weight. They've gained international attention and are an important part of the emerging market story of success. Because of history and differences in their state of development, all will give different weight to strategic objectives, but all will treat economic growth as the imperative. Simply stated, the people want economic growth and the people have standing. The newfound need to maximise living standards is a powerful influence encouraging governments to resist the natural temptation to use economic success to threaten other countries. The opportunity cost of capricious behaviour rises every day. But the transfer of power to individuals has important implications for climate change. Both China and India are looking to expand their economies at an annual rate of the order of 7% per annum. This would be entirely consistent with what they have achieved over the past decade and is what their people and what the people living in India and China expect and want. Such growth is having a dramatic impact on the lives of ordinary people, and it is making an important contribution to human happiness. The problem is that 7% annual growth doubles the GDP of China and India every 10 years. Within three decades, GDP will double, then double again, meaning that by 2039, the combined GDP of these two countries will be 8 times larger than it is today. For most people in China and India, it is simply fanciful to believe that such growth in GDP can be accommodated within a cap on emissions. There might be a technological solution that could make growth of that magnitude feasible, but at this stage, few would be willing to base current emissions policy around such a possibility. It would also be difficult for Americans to agree to a cap in the absence of meaningful constraints on China and India. As China and India become more affluent, there will be growing pressure from people to improve air and water quality, just as there was pressure to do the same in the US and Europe. The result will be more pleasant living conditions in China and India, and this will help. Moreover, continued economic growth in China and India will put further upward pressure on commodity prices, particularly energy prices, and this will have a beneficial impact on investment in renewable energy. An oil price above $150 per barrel has a much bigger impact on alternative energy investment than any system of carbon trading currently contemplated. But it is hard to see how China and India can become more efficient at producing GDP than advanced countries. If developing economy GDP increases by 8 times over the next 30 years, it will have serious negative consequences for the atmosphere and global temperatures, even if they achieve emissions efficiency equivalent to that of advanced countries. At the heart of the problem is the fact that controlling greenhouse gas emissions is a zero-sum game. And because of the way the world has evolved, the effective decision makers in this area are no longer governments, but people. There is no constituency anywhere for people to give up their living standard to enable someone to increase theirs. Low-income countries are more likely to scramble for what is left than to forgo economic growth to protect the existing living standards of advanced countries. Even if governments in China and India were to agree to cap their emissions, there is no way they could deliver. The regions are so powerful in both countries that edicts from the centre are more likely to be humoured than acted upon. The debate, therefore, has to be conducted not with the governments of developing countries, but with their people. This is something that can be done, but it requires a clear understanding of the target audience and why they are important. Well, let me try and summarise that in a conclusion. The European Enlightenment, repelled by the barbarity of religious dogma and intolerance, inspired by the rationality and sense of order of Confucian China, celebrated the nobility of the individual. The English learnt from the violence of their own civil war that tolerance and reason are the only basis for global strength, but they were not willing to embrace the individual as the ultimate decision maker. The Enlightenment found a ready audience in the American colonies, an inspired group locked in a philosophical approach to government that has stood the test of time and which has put the individual centre stage. People around the world instinctively understand and appreciate what a philosophy of equality means. The Declaration of Independence and the self-evident truth that the pursuit of happiness is an unalienable right now have a larger audience than America. Over the last 2 decades, the biggest developing countries have realised that the secret to economic growth and rising living standards involves diminishing the power of the state and its ability to direct the economic behaviour of its citizens. This has brought economic success to a range of large developing economies. Because economic growth is now the priorities, countries behave differently. They are more responsive to the needs of their people, and they are more conscious of maintaining good relations with other countries. Peace and stability is now the watchword. This is all encouraging, as it suggests that the world will be able to handle changes to the economic importance of countries more easily than some have feared. But the subversive quality of the American Revolution has done its work so well that the world has now been turned into an extraordinary economic machine, lifting the living standards of a very large number of previously very poor people. People around the world have been empowered, and for obvious reasons, they want this process to continue. Unfortunately, the growth aspirations of the world are unlikely to be compatible with what is needed to stabilise the world's climate. Because economic success rests on the new power of individuals, people are now the effective decision makers when it comes to addressing climate change. People in successful developing countries are unwilling to take action, which will make it more difficult for them to achieve their economic goals. They will not countenance giving up their living standards to safeguard the living standards of developed countries. This does not mean that the debate cannot change, but it will have to involve people in developing countries, and it is likely that it will require more concrete evidence of the negatives associated with climate change. To some extent, the problem will self-correct because economic growth in China and India will drive commodity prices higher. This will help investment in alternative energy and reduce demand, but it will also encourage greater supply of coal, oil and gas, and of course, nuclear power. The world is more rational than it was and richer, but it is also more difficult to manage. However, democracies can rise to the occasion and deal with great challenges. Using America as an example, their political process could not be more driven by popular opinion, but it was able to abolish slavery, rebuild its banking system and economy after the Great Depression, fight the Second World War, establish civil rights for African Americans, put a man on the moon, and bring dignity and future to its indigenous population. All the noise and complexity of American politics did not stop any of this from happening. The common feature to all these accomplishments was a measure of consensus. And it is this observation that is relevant for the climate change debate. With popular opinion around the world the real decision maker, we need to build a consensus for change in key countries. This is hard to do, but if it's done, dramatic change can follow. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Don. There'll be thanks at the end. I've just been reading my running sheet more carefully, and I didn't. It says Barry Jones returns to the stage. I apologise for having hogged the stage all that time to chair the question and answer session. Now, there's good news because we had in the timetable that we'd only start the question and answers at 8:15. And I assume that the director will allow us to continue to 8:30, which is the due time.
Let's try the first 20 minutes.
All right, let's try the first 20 minutes, he says. All right, who'd like to start off with a question or comment or discussion? The provost, the outgoing provost, I should say.
Well, thank you for a wonderful lecture, and I think you made the point most eloquently about the just what is so revolutionary about 1776 and the notion that the people can govern themselves without a monarch or an upper house. And while in some ways it wasn't as radical as events in France turned out to be, the Republican Revolution is profoundly significant, it seems to me. You were talking about the particular type of American state that emerges from that, and one point that I didn't feel that you quite drew out was that even though the American state was deliberately limited in its grasp, consistent, and essentially wanted people to get on with it, that it did have the capacity to be obeyed. And I think I was struck in thinking about climate change that the Brazilian state, after all, even in Lula's hands, doesn't have that capacity yet to be obeyed. I mean, it's made various pronouncements about what's happening in the Amazonian forest, which just seem to be ignored consistently. And it just struck me that one of the characteristics of the state, which is so important in your analysis, that isn't yet present in a place like Brazil, is that the rule of law is not necessarily adhered to. And in terms of climate change, the consequences are, you know, are profound for the rest of us.
Yes, I think that's an important point. I mean, part of the original structure did give enormous weight to the courts and the legal system. I mean, the fact that the Supreme Court is one of the equal powers and all that was put there quite deliberately because they always saw the legal system as the protector of the individuals. I mean, individuals are only, their position is only as good as the legal system within the system, because otherwise the state will expropriate or do whatever. So in America, you're right, the legal system is very important and people pay attention to it. I mean, there is as much scrutiny of the machinations of the Supreme Court as there is of political parties, probably more. People are more interested in the individual behaviour of individual justices than they are in probably the head of the Senate or whatever, for good reason, because the Supreme Court has a really important say. So, yes, the Americans do have that inbuilt strength, I guess. But I think, but in terms of getting their citizens to obey, it goes back to my other point about the consensus. If there's no consensus, it's very difficult for the American system to do anything. It's a structure where, unless there's a almost, it doesn't have to be overwhelming, but it has to be a significant group of people. But then, once the Americans all agree on something, then amazing things can happen because they can put into place everything that needs to take place. But consensus, the legal system, they go together. But other countries don't have that luxury, I agree.
Who's next? Up the back.
Thank you for a wonderful talk. Not so long ago, we were being extolled to respect Suharto raising millions out of poverty, and yet I don't think there would have been much commitment or shared preoccupation with Enlightenment values. Could you give us any reflections on Indonesia in the scheme you've painted tonight?
Well, I mean, Indonesia is interesting as well. I mean, I'm sure that the Suharto to the end was not a believer in King Mob at all. He had raised himself to the position where he did embody the state. If I'm allowed an anecdote, I remember in Washington, I used to get on quite well with the Indonesian ambassador at the time, and he told me this story about, because he was previously the Indonesian trade minister, and he was very worried because he'd had this, this person who'd chaired one of the committees for so many years, and this person had become really quite old. He was like 85, 86, 87, and he was very concerned going to the president, who was also very old, and suggesting to a very old president that maybe this person who should move on because he was so old. And he finally summoned up his courage and went and explained to him that this person had to leave. And the president just took one look and said, "That person has to go, he's too old." So Suharto had moved on to a position where he saw himself as embodying the nation. But the approach of all his time there was to spread the wealth around. I mean, the economic development there was very much channeled down, to peasants and farmers, and that was all quite conscious. It was about empowering individuals to an extent, but it was certainly not in a sort of democratic. But I think the strength of what they did was the fact that Indonesia did make the transition to democracy surprisingly well, for a country that had no history whatsoever. And I think you can trace that back to, the Suharto legacy, even if though he probably, well, he didn't. I think it was a good way of going. He probably believed in democracy as long as he was the king.
Right, who's next? Yes.
With all due respect, as a transplanted
American...
It's always
dangerous when the question begins to that.
As a transplanted American, I believe you're presenting a somewhat over-romanticized view of the U.S. Certainly great achievements there, including the election of Barack Obama. But on the other hand, as Noam Chomsky has pointed out, the U.S. has a one-party system, a business party with two factions. Of the developed countries in the world, it has the greatest social inequality. Various studies have indicated that the top 1% now owns over 50% of the wealth. The U.S. Has not yet ratified the Kyoto Protocol. And along with China, is the greatest greenhouse gas emitter and is actually greater in terms of per capita greenhouse gas emissions than China because of the smaller population. So anyway, I just want to sort of get your reaction to my observations as a transplanted American.
notwithstanding, I understand what you're saying, but all of that
follows from the decisions they took, you know, right at the beginning, that they were going to empower individuals, and how that power translates into, you know, the community is, rests very much, you know, on how the individuals chose or choose to conduct themselves. Now, if the US had compulsory voting, everything else stayed the same. US had compulsory voting, the country would be completely different. It would be, because people matter, you know, just as people, or just as the political system now recognises that Spanish-speaking people make up a large proportion of the population there, the system will quickly incorporate them. If there was compulsory voting, you would have quite a different structure within the US. So it's, they have chosen not to allow compulsory voting for obvious reasons. I mean, you can see the groups that would be opposed to such a thing, and you can see the groups who'd be in favour of it. And there's a constant battle at a local level in terms of encouraging people to enrol to vote and actually vote. So, you know, it makes for a dynamic society, and then I guess in the long run, they have shown a capacity to self-correct if you end up with consequences which, you know, society doesn't really agree to. Over time, they'll change. Questions about the distribution of wealth will be addressed. I mean, what's happened in the last 30 or 40 years is really quite extraordinary in many ways. And, you know, my guess is that we're living through a cycle at the moment which will make, you know, take some measures to actually rectify that. So all I can say is, you know, that's the system, and God bless it.
No, but look, just to reinforce the point that the questioner made, if you take an area, say, like the public health situation, the extraordinary role of the drug companies, the role of the lobbies in preventing a kind of system of universal health care, I mean, isn't that, you might say that that's a kind of individualism turned on its head, where the people who are the least vocal, the least capable, and so on, are significantly disadvantaged, are they not?
It's, well, my guess is that healthcare is one of those issues that over a period of time the Americans will grapple with and will finally deal with. It's an extraordinary, unfair and inefficient way of providing health to a community where, you know, a significant part of the community is uninsured. And it has catastrophic effects on people who are affected. I mean, if you lose it, I mean, healthcare for most Americans comes through their employment. So if you run into a situation where you've lost your employment, you've basically lost your healthcare. And I think it's going to get a lot worse because a lot of people's healthcare in retirement comes through their pension entitlements. Mm. And it's okay for people who, you know, contributed years ago, but the current situation where most people are on defined contribution, they're going to find that in many cases their actual retirement income is diminished, but they'll also find that they lose health benefits as well. So the Americans are going to be in a situation where the number of people who are outside the health system is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I mean, I know in some respects it's no answer that the problems are getting worse, but my experience with the Americans is that when something of this nature occurs, you do get a response. And my guess is that this Congress, if any Congress is going to deal with the issue, it's this current one. It's got a Democratic majority in it. It's got a president who actually, you know, identifies the problem as something that has to be dealt with. He has a crisis. I mean, a crisis is always good for dealing with these sort of things. So my guess is that, if the Americans don't deal with it in this term or the next term, then it'll be very difficult for them to ever deal with it.
All right, who's next? There and there. The next one down here.
My, is that working. My name is John Reed. I'm an adjunct at one of the other places. My question is this. Given that the world population at the moment is about 6.8 billion, and that we are consuming a third more than the biocapacity of the planet Earth, how is your good governance, how is your stability going to survive a population of 9.5 billion, which is the medium growth forecast, medium growth scenario for the United Nations by 2050?
Well, with some difficulty. I mean, I think we are now burdened with the problems of success. I mean, for 100 years, we've attempted to bring economic growth and development to a whole array of the world's population who were previously just considered so poor and so outside the system that there was nothing that could be done for them or with them. We've ignited growth in a whole array of countries which previously seemed unimaginable. Now, this is great news on one front, but all the problems that, you know, identified in terms of climate, it's actually a shorthand for a whole array of other problems which are related just to the fact that, you know, economic growth is now running and the desires and the ambitions for economic growth are running beyond, you know, our capabilities to actually handle it. And as with all systems, the system is now decentralised. Systems will react, and there will be a process, and, you know, part of that process will be prices, part of that process will be dislocation. The system hopefully will be able to manage itself through it, but my guess is that we're looking at, you know, a period of ongoing instability and concern, but because the price of getting it right is so high, I mean, the incentive to try and manage all of this in a way that enables people who were very poor or less poor to go on getting richer, I'm an optimist. I think the process is self-correcting, but having said that, I think there will have to be a period of dislocation to make it self-correct.
Yes.
Thanks very much, Don, for a most fascinating address tonight. My name's Ian Mentz. I'm an honours student at this university. So, as I followed your lecture, you structured Rear Vision, how we have evolved to where we are today with the West versus the rest. And you embraced four major non-Western nations, India, China, Brazil and Russia, against the traditional West, America and Europe. Can I ask you a rather complicated question? Looking forward now, the threats to world progress, which may make the question that we're looking at tonight quite irrelevant, really. The threats to world progress now, talking in terms of the democracies and the non-democracies, sustainability, secular versus non-secular, and the nation state. As Blaney put in his latest World History, for the first time the nation state is becoming seriously, possibly, under threat as a way of organising man's affairs. So I hope I haven't made that question too. If you could comment, please. Thank you.
Well, I mean, it's always easy to, you know, put together scenarios which are threatening and unpleasant. But I think, you know, what's happened in the last 20 years has reduced some of the usual fears and concerns, which in the past have been based around concerns about conflicts between nation states, as you call them. And that has been the way in which, you know, turmoil and has manifested itself since time immemorial. I think those sort of conflicts and those concerns and those sort of unpleasant possibilities have diminished because of what we've seen through the economic development of a whole array
of countries and the way in which it's come about, which has been decentralizing the power of states and lifting, you know, the individual standing and roles of individuals. And I think that's all been stabilizing. I think the problems that we're going to have to deal with are not the traditional problems of, you know, state v. state. They're more the problems of dealing with of success and the fact that the world population is so enormous, economic growth is already so great. We have problems with climate, with the atmosphere, resources. Those sort of problems are new, and they're not, you know, what we've grown up with in terms of, you know, moving things around maps and stuff. These are new sets of problems. The good news is that the system is decentralized and it does respond to price changes. So it is possible that we will be able to maneuver our way through all of this with some pain and some problems, but the system itself will be sufficiently flexible and the signals will be sufficiently useful and accurate that the thing will equilibrate to something sensible. But it will be a different set of problems that we've wrestled with in the past.
Over there.
Thank you very much, Dr. Russell. I really enjoyed your talk and it gave me a lot to reflect on. One of the things I was reflecting on is the word society. And I recalled somebody I don't like actually recalling voluntarily, and that is Margaret Thatcher, when she said there's no such thing as society, only individuals. And I wondered if we could perhaps have heard a little bit more both of the concept of society and of civil society, which to me, I know you had limitations of time, would have perhaps added another dimension to your talk. It seemed to me that it was concentrating on individual and individual pursuits, so much part of the American dream, but there is also a European dream, as I'll be saying tomorrow, and part of that European dream, in fact the name of the book is actually from an American, Jeremy Rifkin, is very much based on a social concept of markets, on the social market economy, and it is based on looking at alternatives to military might as well. And it's said that, by Mick Cox from the LSE, he said that when the Americans reach for the gun, the Europeans reach for their treaty. Now one of the problems, of course, with your treaty is it can be actually make things quite slow in terms of reaction, like conflict resolution. But nevertheless, I still would argue or suggest to you that you perhaps accord a little bit more attention to the concept of society, and rather than simply consensus in the American context, to also look at the role of protest and participation and the avenues for those roles within America, and indeed its role in promoting those to the world. Thank you.
I think, in fact, you know, what's been happening over the last 20 years is that, I mean, how do you define a society? I don't know. But what has been happening is that societies, if you sort of conceive that as the way in which, you know, communities, people relate to each other and relate to the state and, you know, what's important, the authorities that come from that. What we've seen in a whole array of countries is that societies have become more powerful. You know, they're not all the same. I mean, a Chinese society is different from an Indian society, clearly. But you can say that, in some sense, society in China is a lot stronger than it was 20 years ago, and society in India is a lot stronger than it was 20 years ago. They're different types of societies. And with the Americans, there is a very strong American society. Americans have a very strong sense of how they relate to each other and how they relate. It's sort of different from how Europeans do it, and it is, you know, much more individualistically based. But they do. I mean, it's one thing Australians find when they go to America is just, well, certainly the way they relate to their church, to their relate to their families. They have a very strong patriotic sense. They're very proud of their community, of their nation, of their and what have you. So that they, in their own way, have a very strong sense of society. It's just different from everyone else. But And I think in the American system, their society is really very strong relative to the state. So I think it's that relationship between the state and society that is the has certainly been the driver in terms of in terms of economic development. And I'm not quite sure what Margaret Thatcher really meant, unless I think she was probably arguing against collectivist type.
Yeah.
She saw society as collectivist, whereas in fact, it's not right at all. I mean, American society is not collectivist in that sense, but it has a very strong identity to itself. So I think she was making
it was also anti-trade union, you know, that individual workers could negotiate, but not collectively.
Oh, with Margaret, yes, yes.
Mr. Mellors.
Thanks, Dr. Russell. Very interesting address. The thing I'd like to raise with you is that for one who's 82 years of age and grew up in the Depression, the horizon was never ending for an economy. No one worried about the environment. Now there are economies which are going to have to grow or sustain themselves within environments, and those environments are global. They're not national or broken up into little bits by boundaries. There's the air and the ocean and a whole range of other issues. So that in many, many ways, we've got a different scenario altogether in a world situation where economies have got to exist without destroying an environment, otherwise they haven't got it anymore. And the world, the environment, in fact, is a world system in terms of the ocean and the air. So that we've got a whole new range of issues at play here, which means that somehow consensus is going to have to be not only national, but worldwide in terms of survival.
Yes.
Because we're playing in a different field altogether in that last 100 years.
Yes, no, I agree with that. And that's why it is a very difficult debate. Because we do have to change how we operate. And that's not just Australia, it's the world. And in one sense, you know, the key people have to change are the biggest countries, and they're probably the least capable of doing it. So what do people in, you know, smaller countries do in that sort of environment? Because really the target of the debate is somewhere else. It's not amongst, you know, your own citizens, and it's somebody else's citizens. But the only good news, well, is that, you know, the ways in which people can talk to each other is expanding all the time. And that it is possible to, you know, develop a conversation across boundaries, that because individuals now feel, you know, less, I don't know, overawed by their own governments, there is much more scope now to build national global campaigns. But someone has to make the effort, someone has to do that, someone has to run the campaigns. And I suspect that it requires, you know, a number of, you know, catastrophes. Something which people will all agree that was a very bad thing. Something has to be done about it. And everyone agrees that it happened because of this. And if you get a number of those events, then I think there is scope to build, you know, a global consensus. Because America is very difficult to get to do anything. But when they all agree on something, it happens. And my guess is that if you can do that, you can still do that globally. And because governments around the world now are so much more responsive to the people in them, they're much more inclined, even if they might have their own strategic reasons, thinking this is not, for some reason, not so good idea, they're much more likely to accede to the wishes of, you know, what their communities want. So it's really taking those catastrophes, building a wisdom and an acceptance of that.
Director McCackie raised an index finger before, and I wasn't sure that was a commentary or a warning.
I'd like to ask a question.
Oh, is that what it was? Oh, well.
That's all right.
Dr. Russell, thank you very much for the splendidly large tent you erected tonight in looking at the West. But I thought there was one gorilla in your tent which you weren't altogether observing, and that is the world of Islam, which you made little mention of. And it seems to me that you said at one moment, rather interesting, that Americans have the luxury of having an altruistic element to their foreign policy. I think the Islamic world might have more difficulty than you in believing in that altruistic edge to American foreign policy. Would you agree with that or not?
Oh, sure, they would have trouble with my well, two things. One, I didn't mention Islam, but when you go through the history, the shocking slaughter that the Christian sects engaged in Europe, and the fact I'm totally convinced that the Enlightenment was just a reaction against the 30 Years' War, and you know, this was intelligent people just repulsed by dogma and theology, and it's why they were so attracted to Confucianism. They just thought of the notion that there has to be a better way of organising societies on the basis of notions of the trilogy, or was Jesus really a god or was he not a god, and if you believe this you should be burnt, and if you didn't believe that that was fine. I think and it was clear that the English could have done another round when they got rid of James II. It was all there for them to have another go at it, because he was trying to put the Catholic Church back, but I think they just got exhausted and they said, oh look, we'll just have to let those Catholics operate, we'd have to let the Protestants. And it's just so obvious, looking back on it, that tolerance is actually a key part in development. And while Muslims feel that they should burn people and because their religious views are slightly different, there's no way that economic development can possibly find its way through in the Muslim world. So you can only hope that, in some respects, just as the English got exhausted, just as the Americans decided not to go down that route at all, there'll come a time when people just think, well, this is just ridiculous. But
look, I want to take you up on the following on from that. You see, you've talked about religion in an 18th century context, but you haven't talked about one of the other. I was struck that when you were talking earlier on, you talked about American exceptionalism. One, you never mentioned the R word, and that is the role of religion. The rise and rise of fundamentalism, the rise and rise of some forms of obscurantism, which you have, for example, about the great creation debate. How is it possible that the nation which, Melbourne University aside, contains the world's greatest universities, and at the same time that you've got this extraordinarily low level of scientific scientific knowledge, and indeed a strong anti-science constituency?
Yeah, no, it is a puzzle, and it is actually fortunate that the founding fathers were from that period, the Enlightenment period, and they quite consciously wanted to separate the state from religion, because that was part of the reason why they were doing it. And fortunately, they did put these, very specific barriers into the thing. But what happened was that, the 18th century leaders in America were not particularly religious. I mean, they were deists, or they weren't great believers in Jesus Christ or whatever. They were exhausted with all of that. But then in the 19th century, there was a resurgence of fundamental Christian beliefs. And so the American system had to take on board a much more active religious dimension than that the founding fathers ever thought was appropriate or would exist. But the founding fathers, fortunately, had made it very difficult for any individual religion to seize the control of
the way in which the state operated. And they tried at various state levels, you know, because you'd get a whole group of similar-minded Protestant fundamentalists who would campaign against the Irish and the Catholics and what have you. But fortunately, the system hung together reasonably well. But yes, America is a much more religious country than certainly Australia. Mm. And they fortunately have been able to manage all of that without, because normally once you get God and government together, it's very tricky. Because, you know, if God is God, then what God believes is right. And you can't argue with God.
See, back in 2000, both Al Gore and George Bush had signs on their desk that said, WWJD, what would Jesus do? Could you imagine PJ Keating with a WWJD sign on his desk?
Oh dear. Possibly not.
I don't want to turn to breakfast time here. We'll be back here at 10 o'clock.
All right. Well, you think it's Milo time? All right. Well, this is the stern. The stern voice of the person who's running the show. On your behalf, I want to ask you in a minute to thank Dr. Don Russell. He's made a distinguished contribution at so many levels of Australian society, and he made a strong intellectual contribution tonight, did a very broad and incisive range of explanation as to where the world is going. And no doubt it will be a stimulatory of very many conversations as people wend their way home. This has been a wonderful series. Your contribution has been a very distinguished one. Please join me in thanking Dr. Don Russell.